Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm your host, Mark Moss.
Do you have your tickets for the next Tell Us Something live storytelling event? You can get your tickets online at tellussomething.org. Better yet, though, why not pick up some limited edition printed tickets? These tickets are the same price as the online tickets and feature the beautiful artwork used on the posters. Artwork for the Lost in Translation event was created by Bear River Studios. These special tickets are available exclusively at Rockin' Rudy's. Get your tickets now at Rockin' Rudy's or get the digital version at tellussomething.org.
Just way back there in the heart of the Selway, Bitterroot National Forest. So, yeah, we were at the end of the road and off-grid for 3 weeks. And it looked like me scribbling furiously on a yellow legal pad and then transcribing onto a $100 typewriter that I found at the antique mall beforehand so that I could kind of translate it into print.
This week on the podcast, Rick White and I chat about the story that he told live on stage at the Wilma in Missoula, Montana in December of 2019. The theme that night was tipping point. We also talk about podcasting, writing, his artist residency, and storytelling. Thank you for joining me as I take you behind the scenes at Tell Us Something to meet the storytellers behind the stories. In each episode, I sit down with a Tell Us Something storyteller alumni. We chat about what they've been up to lately and about their experience sharing their story live on stage. Sometimes we get extra details about their story and we always get to know them a little better. I caught up with Rick in September of 2020.
Early on in COVID, got awarded a writing residency or an art residency through a local organization called Open Air. And pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I know Stoney.
Yeah, Stoney's great. Her program's really fantastic. So, yeah, I was fortunate. I got a three-week residency in the Selway Bitterroot in a cabin down there, the Paradise Guard Station, to work on writing. So, that was the highlight of the summer for sure, right in the middle of July.
We are talking about a local nonprofit, Open Air. Open Air provides artist-in-residence programs for artists from all disciplines who are local, national, and international. Residencies last for 4 to 6 weeks. Open Air believes that artists are critical to our community's vitality and help to strengthen the creative capacity of Western Montana and foster dialogue and experiences that are culturally vibrant, healthy, and intellectually vigorous. You can visit tellussomething.org for a link to Rick's Open Air talk.
So what did that look like?
That looked like my girlfriend and I and our two dogs living at the Paradise Guard Station, which was a one-room cabin attached to a campground that is where people who float the Selway River, one of the premier rafting destinations and rivers in the country, the wild and scenic river. It's the put-in for that. It's at the end of a road about 48 miles down from Darby, Montana. Just way back there in the heart of the Selway, Bitterroot National Forest. So, yeah, we were at the end of the road and off-grid for 3 weeks. And it looked like me scribbling furiously on a yellow legal pad and then transcribing onto a $100 typewriter that I found at the antique mall beforehand so that I could kind of translate it into print. So it was very romantic, maybe Hemingway or Faulkner-esque, if you're thinking of those pictures, but the quality of the writing, not close to that, but it was wonderful. Stoney's program was really fantastic. I think kind of like Tell Us Something, just local organizations just doing tremendous things for artists and storytellers and creative folks. Really just super impressed with what she's doing.
And so I've seen some of the residencies that she's had with visual artists. How will we get to see your work?
Yeah, that's good. Artists donate one thing to them. So she's planning a type of display, maybe a traveling exhibit, depending on COVID, I think, to show off different folks' work. So I'll be donating a poem that I wrote there and maybe some other things as needed. She took a lot of great photos, and we have some different resources from the Selway Bitterroot Frank Church Foundation
So I think that will be how she does that. I also had a reading that I gave at the conclusion of the residency about 2 weeks later in August, and she recorded that. Stoney recorded that, and we'll put it up on YouTube. She's busy finishing up the residency season right now, but she's working on uploading those to YouTube and then on their website, openairmt.org, I believe.
Yeah.
And how it's all shifting right now and shaping. I know Free Flow, I'm working with them on their podcast and doing interviews and stuff.
We talked a little bit more about writing workshops before I asked Rick about his work with the Free Flow Institute.
Chandra was, forced to cancel a lot of those writing workshops that she does on the rivers, the river trips. I was scheduled to go with David James Duncan down the Salmon River, which was going to be a spectacular trip, but that got postponed until next year. But they did a similar thing, designed a 5-week writing workshop called Shift, which sounds kind of like the one that you took for 10 weeks, in which it was, engaging with these themes of shift and transition. It's been interesting to watch how these circumstances have forced evolution. In some ways good, in some ways, how much Zoom can you handle in a day,
Totally.
In your life? It's frustrating,
yeah.
at that level, certainly, and I think everybody, because the Zoom fatigue and everything is a real thing. But if you can step back from it, there was a real blossoming of some really interesting creative things that would not have happened otherwise outside of this year,
Right, and I think once we get a vaccine and it is safe to gather in person again, Zoom will also offer a balance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That we probably wouldn't have otherwise embraced.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Something it will get winnowed down into the best of those things will rise to the top, and we'll get to continue using those
right.
formats and mediums.
Yep. So, can you talk about the podcast?
Yeah, the Free Flow podcast or
yeah.
Telesomething podcast.
Flow podcast.
Sure, I'd love to. So we got interrupted in February. I did the first Chris Latray, local writer who's done local Telesomething storyteller, I think of a few times, right?
Yep. He's done it at least twice.
Yeah, such a great guy and a willing guinea pig for our experiment. We went walking out at Council Grove together in February on a pretty snowy day and talked about his first book, One Sentence Journal, that won the Montana Book Award and some High Plains Book Awards as well. So we got to talk about that, and a lot of that deals with grief and loss and creativity and everything. So that was a really wonderful thing. The idea behind the Free Flow podcast is to do similar to the Free Flow trips, the river trips, to kind of simulate an experience of being outside with a writer. So I get, a lot of ambient sounds and structure them as as sort of mini journeys. So there's a lot of heavy editing involved on the back end, on the production side. So I interviewed Chris and spent quite a bit of the time during COVID working that one episode up and editing it into a kind of pilot episode to pitch to potential funders, but was interrupted with COVID and unable to continue interviewing folks, and funding requests were delayed. So we're still looking and searching for some funding for that. But in the last month, I've gotten to go interview Hal Herring, an award-winning outdoor journalist who's based up in Augusta. And then just last week, I sat down with David James Duncan on the Bitterroot River, and then at a little farm where he rents a cabin for his workspace out in Target Range. And We got some other folks lined up on the docket for the rest of the month, this year, in hopes of releasing a handful of episodes in the springtime, in the early springtime, ahead of next year's free flow river season. Fingers crossed, if COVID allows. So,
yeah,
it's been a really great project. It's really fun to kind of peer. We center it on the themes kind of a free flow trip, which is the conversations about craft, about the writing craft and the storytelling craft, about conservation, and they're most of our writers or storytellers are involved in some way in conservation, be it public lands or free flowing rivers or any number of climate change, any number of things. Who's not involved in that these days? You know, I think we all are kind of, our hand has been forced to be involved in that writing. So conversation about craft and conservation, and then the creative life. So I get to talk to them kind of about, especially working writers. It's really fascinating for me to see, you know, how they construct their days and how they, you know, Dave James Duncan's been working on he's at 1,200 pages on this manuscript he's been working on since 2007 or 2008, I believe. So, you know, what does it look like to work on a book for 12 years on a daily, monthly, weekly basis? So it's been really, really wonderful conversations, and folks have been really gracious, and many of them will lead trips, river trips next year. That'll be writing workshops for people interested in what they were, you know, their writing. You know, if you're a David James Duncan fan, you've got access to him that you don't get otherwise. He doesn't really do much. So pretty fantastic organization. It's just really, you know, the Missoula community, it's wild how supportive this community is of passionate creatives and making those things happen. It's even during trying times, it seems like it's a priority here. So it's really just a wonderful place to be right now.
Well, and you got a powerhouse lineup in your podcast roster. You know, first batter, so to speak, with Chris Latray, that book.
Oh, man.
One sentence journal. I mean, it. You know, if you haven't been outdoors for a while and you read one sentence journal, you can't help but go outside. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he really makes it like, yeah, it's like, oh, God. When I read it, it was winter, which I think is Chris's favorite time of year. Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Most of the book is set in winter.
Yeah. Right. And you talk about loss and grief, and I think Darla the Wonder Dog died during that time, and
yep,
and you know, I think one of my cats died, and I was like, oh yeah, I get it, but man,
yeah,
what a great book! Book,
and the chance to walk around with him at a place that he was taking Darla, you know, in her last days, and just to see him experience and be able to narrate, like, you know, this is where she would run around, or this is her favorite place to do this, and to get choked up when he read some selections from it and got choked up talking about her, you know, it's just a pleasure, and that's the idea, is just to kind of get those authors out there, get people like Chris out there, where the ideas are being generated, and where his connection to his creative practice is really, really blossoming, so,
yeah. Unrelated, have you ever seen his band, American Falcon?
I haven't. No, I talked to him a little bit about his music. He was really wanting to talk about his book, but I made him talk about it. How's American Falcon?
I saw them play in the VFW like 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Travis Yost is in the band as well. And I can't remember who else. And I went with Ryan Bundy. You know Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, Ryan, you like this kind of music? And he's like, bring your earplugs. It's going to be awesome. And we went, and it was like Black Sabbath meets Kiss.
Yeah.
I mean, it was ear-splittingly, beautifully grungy, and it was awesome. Like, Like, I try not to overuse that word, but it was like, what did I just experience? And even with the earplugs, you know, my ears were ringing for days.
That is definitely, you can tell Chris comes from that genre authentically and just loves it. So wonderful.
Yeah,
I have not seen their band, but
oh, and his kid was in the band too.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it was like, so the energy in the room, it was like Henry Rollins would love this shit. You know what I mean? It was so cool.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's fun to watch him too, like, highlight authors that he loves. And I've been reading or listening to his poetry that he does on public radio. It's nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, we spent a good half hour just talking about Jim Harrison, one of our favorites, one of our mutual favorites. Wonderful stuff.
So when you told your story at Tell Us Something, did you have the whole thing written out already, or was that part of like the workshopping process at Tell Us Something? Was that part of like how you got your final piece written?
That's a good question. Speaking of workshops, I had, and generative workshops like you participated in, I had, I guess it was that summer, last June, had gone down to Denver to the White House Writers Workshop for a week-long generative workshop with Melissa Phoebos, who now teaches over at Iowa. She was in New Jersey last year, but she just got a job in Iowa, and she was doing a workshop on the very short essay. So I went down there looking to kind of learn and generate some short essays in the 1,000-word or less range. And that was the first piece that I produced. She had us read Annie Dillard's Weasel essay, kind of the famous short essay on creative practice and singular focus. And then Melissa, you know, gave us a prompt, and I chose to write that essay about teaching, because it was a prompt about a time in your life, or an experience in your life when you were singularly focused on one thing, one activity or one job. And for me, it took me back to when I was teaching high school as a first year high school teacher in a really challenging environment. High-performing charter school for low-income students, low-income Latino students in inner-city Denver. So that came to mind, and I pumped out a draft of that essay overnight in the first night of that workshop, and yeah, something true came out of it, and I got a good response. So I kind of just held on to that and had it in my back pocket as a story that I wanted to try to publish, wanted to refine, and but just kind of had it there. And I think when I pitched to Tell Us Something, pitched a story for that event, I pitched another essay about another story I had told in various formats and hadn't really written down, but had told orally, and just did a terrible job on the pitch. Just I think you give a 10-minute thing, and I think I rambled to 30 minutes on the phone.
No, the pitch line is 3 minutes, and then when we did the workshop, we did the first initial phone workshop, I think you did went like 16 or 20 minutes long or something like that.
Okay. It felt like 2 hours.
I
couldn't slow that train down.
It sort of did feel long because the story was pretty brutal. And at the time I didn't know you at all, and I was like, how am I going to tell this guy he can't tell this story?
Who is this guy? It was a story of slipping down a moral slope, you know, and it got necessarily brutal, and it was, I think just not the story And learning from you, that's one great lesson I learned in the workshop process with you specifically, which was, you know, there's a time and a place for certain stories, and sometimes you have to retire stories or just shift. It's not just as simple as like knowing your audience, but just knowing, you know, where certain stories belong in time. And it certainly wasn't the right time, certainly wasn't the right place. The way I think I told it to you initially, it was still a very kind of personal inside story between people who kind of knew me and knew the character, knew my buddy Hayden, who was part of that story. And it was a challenging thing, but man, what a valuable experience to get to share it with you and have your feedback and kind of go through it. And then by the time we got to workshopping it with the other storytellers, I had switched. I kind of realized that for the theme I'm blanking right now on the theme of that tipping point is what it was that
thing. Right.
That I had that other essay in my back pocket, which totally fit the theme, and that was about teaching. So yeah, I had that to refer to. Yes, I did have it written out, but it wasn't in its final form, so it allowed me to kind of keep working on that. And I guess since I had that script and had it all kind of written out already, it made it for easy reference. I'm kind of a visual learner, so it was nice to have that to sit down with and look through and kind of know the turns of the story and how to keep it going. So I told it orally for the first time without just reading it, to, like I did in the workshop, to our group over at your house. And then from there, just kind of refined it and told it live on stage at the Wilma.
Yeah. Those were the days.
Yeah, those were the days.
But it was great the way you approached it, because, you know, I asked you to sign a release form and you said, I will, and I want you to not publish this until after the written version is published.
Yeah, and, hoping and, that it would get published, you know.
Right.
Sure.
And I really appreciate the way you approached that and how graceful you were with that. And even if you would have said, no, I don't want you to ever publish this, that would have been fine too.
Sure.
I've worked with other authors who, after the fact, like after I had already done all the work in post-production of publishing their story, then they call me and they're like, can you take that down? And I'm like, why didn't you just tell me ahead of time, you know?
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. It's such an interesting industry, and I'm just on the front edge of it. Hopefully I get some more things published. I'm in the MFA program now. I just started it this year here at Montana. So we'll see what comes of that and how far I go. But just the early stages of this, it is complicated. It is really publication to publication on, you know, the first time rights and how long they get first time rights and how they get released. So it's just a whole world to learn to navigate. So yeah, I was fortunate that the spring that story, the written version of that story, got published at High Desert Journal, a really great online journal that's publishing some really important and really, really wonderful work from writers out west, writing about the west, that they published it. And yeah, and we're gracious in the thing. I think they're such a great publication. I think they want to get good work out there, and they're not overly concerned with, you know, I think they'll love hearing a podcast version of it, you know, slightly different, of course, because I just kind of recited a version close to it. I think they'll love seeing that version and across, cross-genre work of audio and written. So, yeah.
I think it'll be fun. I mean, it'll be the first time many people will have heard the story. Many people who attend Tell Us Something maybe weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, since then, we've gotten new followers. So for anybody that wasn't there, this will be the first time they've heard the story, and it'll be certainly interesting for people who have read it to hear the difference between a written story and a spoken story.
Yeah, and what a wild difference. We were talking about that via email.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, I mean, to listen to that, to any story orally versus to read it on the page. And I come from the South. I come from very much the person, my grandfather was the person I learned storytelling from, and he's since passed away in the last couple of years, but he was just an oral storyteller, and certainly not illiterate, but not engaged with the written word in any way. In his storytelling, so I learned storytelling in the campfire kind of way, you know. But my version of it generally is I don't know, some blend of that oral tradition and the written word that I gained later, and an appreciation for storytelling on the page. And I'm still trying to navigate that. I think I don't even know that I have to choose one or the other. It's just really, really, it'll be fascinating to see this in both places, you know, and who responds to it in different ways. I feel like I write in a voice, in an oral voice. Mm-hmm. I write in a way that is meant to be read aloud, rather than on the page. And I don't know what your experience reading it, reading that story on High Desert Journal versus listening to it was, and how you responded, if that voice came through or not. But
well, for me, I mean, it felt like, you know, if you see a movie before you read the book, then your reading of the book is informed by how the movie was.
Sure.
And so it was very similar like that for me. Like,
interesting.
I had seen you perform the story first, and I'd seen a couple different iterations of it before you even performed it. And then once I got to the written word, I listened to it with my eyes. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
I was reading it, but I was hearing your actual voice.
It.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting to talk to somebody who's never heard it after they listen to it and see, you know, and see what's their experience.
Yeah, if they were like, oh man, you could have done better on the page if you'd...
who knows?
This,
I mean,
this, that, and the other, who knows, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you do have to make a choice of one or the other, and I think it's valuable to do both. And I've had, you know, Chris is an example of that, so is Mark Gibbons.
Uh-huh.
Where they do readings, and they have this blend of storytelling and then reading from the page, and then this great banter back and forth with the participants who are there. And
yeah.
I think like blending storytelling, oral storytelling with written, I think is key.
Yeah. My question for you would be, I mean, I know the spirit of Tell Us Something is to perform a story, you know, that's been workshopped for basically to curate the listening experience and make sure, you know, you don't do like I did on the phone that day and take a 10-minute story and drift to 20 or 30 and just ruin everyone's experience. But my question for you would be like, what is it? How do you feel about stories like that are really carefully written out beforehand and in my case, more or less just recited from memory, not to the word, but pretty close to the word. How do other folks do that? And to what effect do you feel like it has in Tell Us Something, in a lineup of, say, eight storytellers?
I would say that, you know, for a long time I said avoid the temptation to write out your story. Mm-hmm. And I stand by that, because sure. What you did is a hard thing to do. You wrote a story, and then you said just now that you recited it, but it didn't come off that way. Mm-hmm. It came off fresh and like you were actually telling and sharing a story from memory. And that wasn't, you weren't trying to remember every comma and every pause and every word.
Right.
And that's because you're a writer and you're a professional writer. And
sure.
Often people who aren't writers, when they try to write out their story, then they try to memorize what they've written and they get up on the stage and they're not sharing a story. They're trying to remember what they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not actually immersed in it anymore. They're,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so it's a tough balance.
Safety blanket rather than a
And I can certainly see the value in writing it out ahead of time.
Sure.
And so for people who are insistent on that, I try to compromise with them and encourage them not to write it out like they would an essay.
Mm-hmm.
But instead to draw it, like make a mind map and just write bullet points instead.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that, you know, if they forget something, they don't get hung up on that and they can just keep going.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and everybody's got a different process.
Sure.
I've watched storytelling workshops by other professional storytelling organizations that say, you know, the first version of your story, you should write it out longhand. Then you should transcribe it. Then you should practice it. Then you should revise it. And it's always going back to the written form. And then by the time you're done with your story, when you're ready to perform it, you know it so well that you don't need to try to remember what you've written.
Mm.
And that's a whole different way to approach it. And that's not, you know, certainly not how I approach it.
Right. I think that's just a very particular process for certain people. But I think your way is better for a community storytelling event. Something about that vulnerability up there on stage. Not that standing up in front of 800 people and reading or reciting and like doing anything is not vulnerable, but there is some intimacy that's really exchanged there when someone is off the cuff and true magic happens. I know in our performance there, there were a couple of stories that we had workshopped together at your house that I was kind of concerned about because the story wasn't really coming together it was rambling or whatever. And then those guys and gals just crushed it on the stage. And it was all these surprising little twists and turns came out. And, you saw people who were actually born performers and really thrived off the crowd energy, and responded to funny little asides that we hadn't even heard in workshop. It was wonderful to see that happen. And you just can't do that if you write out a story ahead of time and are trying to recite it close to it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you do that. You write it out ahead of time, and where you think the jokes are going to land, sometimes they don't land, and then that throws you off, or
mm-hmm.
there are jokes where you didn't expect them, and then you're thrown off, and it's like, you know, that's one of the things, like you say, the magic of the event, the evening, is the exchange that's going on between the storyteller and the crowd,
uh-huh.
Who I like to think of as participants in a conversation or a dialogue.
And hopefully, good participants, constructive participants.
Yeah,
you had that
certainly
opposite that.
Yeah.
That was a wild time. Really interesting experience, but your vision of them as the audience, as participants, is 100% the case. There's just so many, you know, noises made, expressions of that was one wonderful thing about telling the story on stage, was just knowing when something that I was saying was falling as I intended it to, and vice versa, just because you could hear people sighing or you could hear people laughing or whatever it was. And it really does feel like a kind of a co-constructive experience of storytelling and listening. And it will be interesting to hear it again and hear it when it's on the Tell Us Something podcast, to hear it versus reading it. And, you know, my parents and have shared it with people, you know, down south, the written version of it, and it's kind of made the rounds around my friends. So I've gotten feedback on the written version, but it'll be interesting to see what it feels like to listen to it again and to hear that.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear what you think of it once we hear it again. Because I don't know if did I send you a copy of it?
You did. And I listened to it back then. I think that was January or something. So it's been, been quite a while since I listened to it.
Yeah. Is there anything about your story that didn't come out either in the writing or in the performance of it that you want to share with our listeners?
I haven't thought about that. I don't think so. That experience was defined so much of my life for so many years as being a teacher. There's so many experiences I could write, you know, 10,000 words just on my first day of teaching, and what it's like to stand up in front of a group of ornery ninth graders, who, you know, should be ornery, and, you know, stand up there with most of them not having English as their native tongue, and me not speaking Spanish well enough to really know what they're saying under their breath, and to face that. I could write days about that, but I feel like just trying to channel my experience as a teacher and concentrate it down. I feel like I succeeded to a large enough degree in this story. It's something that I'll continue writing about different facets of and different experiences. But for what I was going for in the tipping point, as far as, you know, nearing my own tipping point of breaking and not being able to maintain whatever control of the classroom, or whatever shorthand you want for that. I feel like I told it all in the story and wrote it all out. So yeah, I don't think there's anything missing from it. It does require context of it being Denver in the early 2010. So I think that was actually 2010, September of 2010. So yeah. I don't know if the time. I think I'm in the spoken version that Tell Us Something. I located that time and place, but just in case, it was 2010 in inner city Denver. That's where I was teaching. So a lot has changed since then in Denver and in the world. So yeah.
Well, Rick, I appreciate you spending time with me today, and I appreciate you remembering that it was today.
Absolutely.
In the time of COVID, it seems like time is a weird construct, and
it really is.
I don't remember to write it down, it's not going to happen. So I appreciate you picking up my slack.
Absolutely, Mark. No problem. I can't tell you how many appointments I've missed. I got an email last night from someone who I promised to write a blog post for, and by the end of September. No. Look at that. Today's the end of September.
Yes, sir. Exactly.
Today, you know, so it's
I have faith in you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
thanks for calling and talking. It's fun to talk about this stuff.
Yeah,
I'm excited to hear
really
about your workshop.
Well, good. I'm glad you appreciate it. And good luck with writing today, and have an awesome rest of your week.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Yeah, enjoy the weather. It's going to be
All right, you too. Weekend.
All right, thanks, Mark.
All right, thanks, Rick.
Coming up after the break.
So I had a few letters behind my name. those letters and what they signified of what I had earned or what I thought I had earned mattered less to my students than did the name preceding them, which was not Soshil.
Stay with us. Do you have your tickets for the next Tell Us Something live storytelling event? You can get your tickets online at tellussomething.org. Better yet, though, why not pick up some limited edition printed tickets? These tickets are the same price as the online tickets and feature the beautiful artwork used on the posters. Artwork for the Lost in Translation event was created by Bear River Studios. These special tickets are available exclusively at Rockin' Rudy's. Get your tickets now at Rockin' Rudy's or get the digital version at tellussomething.org.
Much of my first year as a high school geography teacher in inner city Denver, I spent debating whether or not to pick the stapler up off the desk and throw it through the classroom window. Would the violence of intentionally shattered glass regain for my students the attention that I had lost? Would it somehow assert the authority that the professionally framed master's degree on the wall behind my desk did not? Or would it just get me fired and likely jailed? Was prison really that much worse than teaching ninth grade? For the first 88 days of that school year, I arrived at school at 7 a.m., left at 7 p.m., drove to Chipotle, bought a chicken burrito, ate a chicken burrito, drove home, walked my lonesome hound dog around the block, graded papers for a few hours, wrote lesson plans until I passed out on the couch, then descended into fitful nightmares as I slept. In my dreams, I stood in front of the same whiteboard on which I wrote neatly bullet-pointed lecture notes in real life. In my dreams, I addressed the same low-income Latino students who I taught in real life. In my dreams, I wore some combination of the same five dress shirts and the same five neckties that I wore to class in real life, all while being strangulated by a half Windsor noose and slowly dying of the embarrassment of lecturing to my students while not wearing any pants. I was a teacher, but if my students ever thought of me as such, not once in those first three sleepless months did they ever let me know. On good days, I was bato, or wey, dude. On bad days, I was pendejo, asshole, cabrón, bastard, sometimes even puta. Just Google that one. At least I was those things until I let on to my students that I knew more Spanish than they thought I did. They whispered and muttered their names for me amongst each other at their desks. But to my face, my students always called me the same thing. Mr. Not Mr. White, like I had introduced myself to them, because it was my name. Not even Mr. Rick, which I would have accepted and might have even preferred. No, just little M. Mr. Like they were trying to bum some change off of me, the stranger. Strolling down the sidewalk of their lives. Hey, mister, said Fernando one day, his voice at age 14 already an octave lower than mine at 27. Fernando carried himself with the casual confidence of a bato who'd always been big for his age. He had a good 20 pounds on me and proudly sported a tuft of stubble on his chin, which jutted upward when he spoke, which was usually just to crack a joke. Hey, mister! Although I had just concluded was just finishing a riveting lecture on latitude and longitude, I was surprised by Fernando that day because his voice conveyed a sense of genuine curiosity. Hey, mister. Then I was concerned because curious students in my classroom were a kind of endangered species, or as we in Capital E Education might call, at risk. Yes, Fernando? I said, hey, mister, who do you think is better, Messi or Ronaldo? In case you're wondering, Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo were not the world's two most famous geographers, but the world's two most famous soccer players. Mr. White, in the classroom with the stapler. The expectation from the school administration that year was bell-to-bell instruction. So bell-to-bell instruction was what my students got. 4-page daily lesson plans. Exit tickets at the end of every class to prove that my students had learned what I had tried to teach them. 6 formative assessments and 1 summative assessment every other week. This, the studies said, would close the gap. This, my principal said, would get my low-income Latino students to college. This, the wealthy founders of the high-performing charter school network said, would deliver my students to the promised land, that mythical paradise of co-ed dormitories and full-ride scholarships and all-you-can-eat cafeteria buffets. Mythical paradise that one enters as a timid, unsophisticated freshman and exits with a bona fide college degree, that golden ticket to the joyride of the American middle class. Signed, stamped, and guaranteed to get you the job of your dreams. That job that gives you purpose and meaning in your otherwise purposeless and meaningless existence. That job with a 6-figure salary, good health benefits, and a supportive work environment governed by a boss who prioritizes work-life balance over all other things. Or something like that. In that world, the world of higher education, I had been something. I had recently graduated summa cum laude. In my students' world, though, or at least in that intersection where our latitudes and longitudes crossed, in that world, in my classroom, I was just a rookie in a room full of hardened vets, whiter than a saltine cracker and greener than the left side of the Mexican flag. So I had a few letters behind my name. Those letters and what they signified of what I had earned or what I thought I had earned mattered less to my students than did the name preceding them, which was not Xochitl, name of both a Toltec queen and a feisty freshman girl with thick black eyeliner who sat in the second row of desks. Xochitl, girl whose name even her Spanish-speaking friends had trouble pronouncing, much less her white bread teachers, so she shortened it, she said, in the 6th grade, around the time that her cousins and uncles started getting gunned down in Mexican border towns, casualties of the escalating drug war there. No, my name was not Xochitl. My name was not Rogelio either, and my father had not been deported in September for failing to signal for a left turn. My last name was not Guerrero, not Alvarez, not Trejo. And the status of my U.S. citizenship was so secure that I could not have even told you where my Social Security card was, much less would I have needed to. The name on my student or my school ID badge was not Alicia Martinez. And though I did not go to the house parties that my non-teacher friends invited me to each weekend, because I spent every minute of my so-called free time, including weekends, grading papers and writing lesson plans, or dreaming about grading papers and writing lesson plans, I could have gone to any of such house party on any given Saturday without fear of being murdered and dismembered and stuffed into plastic garbage bags in some pendejo's garage. I must have missed that lecture in graduate school, the one in which my professor explained the proper classroom management technique to employ on the Monday in class when every kid has just seen the picture of their friend and classmate, Alicia Martinez, on the Sunday evening news. No, my name was not Xochitl. It's not Rogelio. It's not Alicia Martinez. My name was Mr. What, Fernando? Mister, I'm serious. Messi or Ronaldo? Fernando, I said. Your question could not have less to do with today's lesson on latitude and longitude. for that matter, not Lionel Messi of Argentina, not Cristiano Ronaldo of Portugal, not even Javier Chicharito Hernandez of Mexico, has anything to do with the subject of geography at all. None whatsoever. But the answer to your question, sir, is Messi by a mile. And if you'll open your textbook to page 456 to the world map and give me the coordinates of Buenos Aires, Argentina, Lisbon, Portugal, Mexico City, Mexico, I'll give you and every other white in class a perfect score on today's exit ticket. And we'll call it good for today, how about that? And that's when the nightmares ended. That day in early November, just after Dia de los Muertos, the day I learned to meet my students where they're at, the day my education began. Thank you.
Richard Harrison White is a writer from Northeast Arkansas. He is the author of Can't Go, Can't Stay, a yet-to-be-published memoir of the year he spent on a grief journey with his rascal of a grandfather and a taxidermied raccoon. Once upon a time, he was a schoolteacher. Rick produces the podcast for Free Flow Institute in Missoula, Montana. Thanks, Rick, and thank you for listening today. For a link to the Free Flow Institute podcast and to learn more about Rick White, visit tellussomething.org.
The Tell Us Something podcast is made possible in part because of support from Missoula Broadcasting Company, including the family of ESPN Radio, The Trail 103.3, Jack FM, and Missoula's source for modern hits, U104.5. Learn more at MissoulaBroadcasting.com. Thanks to Float Missoula for their support of the Tell Us Something podcast. Learn more at FloatMSLA.com, and thanks to the team at MissoulaEvents.net. Learn about all of the goings-on in Missoula at MissoulaEvents.net. Thanks to Cash for Junkers, who provided the music for the podcast. Find them at cashforjunkersband.com. Do you have your tickets for the next Tell Us Something live storytelling event? You can get your tickets online at tellussomething.org. Better yet, though, why not pick up some limited edition printed tickets? These tickets are the same price as the online tickets and feature the beautiful artwork used on the posters. Artwork for the Lost in Translation event was created by Bear River Studios. These special tickets are available exclusively at Rockin' Rudy's. Get your tickets now at Rockin' Rudy's or get the digital version at tellussomething.org. To learn more about Tell Us Something, please visit tellussomething.org.